Oak Session number 13206, Reel 2.
Mr. Revel, Reel 2.
Fill flow from the drop tank was selected from the cockpit. Initially, with the tank fitted and filled with fill, engine runs were carried out to confirm engine performance and fill transfer. As fill transfer snags became apparent, any rectification seemed to warrant the removal of the tank after draining the fill. Provision for drainage had been made requiring removal of a screwed bung in the bottom of the tank. Using the usual Zwicky nozzle of the carrier's refueling facility in the hangar to suck out fill from the filler orifice worked if a piece of rubber hose was used to extend the nozzle. Invariably, there was a need to get the last several gallons out from the tank drain point into 5-gallon drums. At times, it became necessary to resort to the 5-gallon drums at a very early stage of draining. Various attempts were made to improve on the integrity of the tank connections, as it was thought that there was insufficient suction due to air leaks. Each attempt to prove adjustments required refitting the tank, partial refueling and ground running. Some smaller improvements were made, but this was not satisfactory, and that lack of success was the most probable reason for the return to Gibraltar. With the urgency to get the Spitfire serviceable and off to Malta, the risks taken in this draining of fuel into drums, etc., in the hangar, with drums of fuel being slid across the steel deck to points where they could be drained, was somewhat hazardous, but had to be taken. Fortunately, there was no fire in spite of significant spillage. During the 1st of March, we continued putting the finishing touches to the aircraft, and on the 2nd, the majority were given daily inspections. Some items of equipment, including some of the pilot's personal essentials, were stowed. At this time, the Germans were claiming damage to HMS Eagle and Malaya. On the 3rd, details of the handling party to accompany the aircraft on Eagle when ready were announced, and I found that I was the only sprog included. There was no need for all the assembly party to go. On March the 4th, an expert from England arrived to help diagnose the fuel transfer problem. A tank had been positioned on the hangar floor for his attention. When he arrived, I think he was still in formal evening clothes, having been given very short notice to leave England by air. I believe his name was Mr. Black, and I have since been given a copy of the Vickers Armstrong Submarine Works report he raised, which shows he was able to put his finger on the trouble as soon as he saw the underside of the tank. He pointed out that a small bulbous protrusion in the lowest point of the tank was a sump, and from his knowledge of the internals of the tank, explained that the fuel transfer pipe reached within a very short distance from the bottom of the sump. Any damage to the sump during handling of the tank might possibly obstruct the fuel pipe and prevent transfer. From the foregoing, it can be imagined that the tanks had taken some punishment during uncrating, loading, assembly, engine running, etc. The remedy for damaged sumps was to cut away enough material to be able to dress out the dents, etc., and then solder a patch over the cutaway area. It worked, and a lesson was learnt by all. Obviously, a maximum effort was made to rectify all damaged tanks and prove that fuel transfer was satisfactory. Eagle put to sea early on March the 5th, and all aircraft were run up. The armourers were able to prove cannons and machine guns by firing them out to sea, with each aircraft pointed in a safe direction in turn. I have a note that suggests that enemy aircraft were fired on that day and that all aircraft were ready for takeoff tomorrow, the 6th of March, 1942. However, I recall that we had been told over the ship's tannoy, which kept us fairly well informed on happenings, that takeoff would coincide with the arrival overhead of a Blenheim en route from Gib to Malta. The Blenheim would lead the Spitfires to Malta, thus relieving the Spitfire pilots of worries concerning navigation. At the appointed time, each early morning on March the 6th, the Blenheim did not appear, and we heard that it was US in Gib, and takeoff would therefore be delayed for 24 hours, so we steamed around until next day. If my dates are right and my memory serves me correctly, the takeoff did take place on March the 7th. We got 15 away. The 16th was still the Christmas tree, led by squadron leader S.B. Grant. He quotes that date in a letter he sent to me in October 1981, many years later. when Ray Honeybone, a corporate engine fitter in those days of 1942, was trying to organise a reunion. At the time he wrote the letter, Stan Grant had been retired from the Royal Air Force as an Air Vice Marshal with the CB and DFC, but some of the Jenny's letter was not correct. I met him a year or so later whilst he was visiting England from his retirement home in the south of France. His birthplace, Sandhurst Grange, is just round the corner from where I have lived since I left the RAF in 1968. I asked him to tell me how the operation, which was codenamed Spotter, had been organised, and to my surprise I learned that in the same way as we humble Irks didn't know where we were going or what we were going to do, we went to Kirkham, etc., neither did he. Sealed orders were opened after a prescribed period at sea, he said. He did inform me about his preparation by telling me that at the end of 1941 he was the commanding officer of No. 65 Squadron, operating Spitfires from Castle Camps as a satellite from Debden. I have since learned, incidentally, that as pilot officer Grant, he had served with 65 during the Battle of Britain. At the end of 1941, they were told to paint their Spitfires black as they were going night fighting. In the early hours of a January morning in 1942, he was called from his bed to read a signal instructing him to report to St. Evel immediately. There he met up with a number of other Spitfire pilots, and all of them were given a few hours to familiarise themselves with flying Spitfires with a large tank located under one wing. A bitch to handle, he said. Having put the required number of hours in, about eight I think, they were all told to report to RAF Kirkham, but could have a 48-hour pass that weekend before reporting there. So I gather that he and his pilots, later to join others who had flown in advance to Malta by Sunderland, and together were to enhance the history of 249 Squadron, were also unaware of what was to happen. Incidentally, that idea of one tank under the wing must have been abandoned, because our tank was fitted on the aircraft centre line. In his letter, Stan Grant had referred to his Spitfires being ferried around to the airfield at Gibraltar, known as North Front, after our abortive attempt to fly them off from Eagle. But that was the second batch of 16, led by Wing Commander Jumbo Gracie. Once the aircraft had safely flown off from Eagle, we returned to Gibraltar to rejoin our pals who had remained there when we sailed to fly off. We all went ashore and were accommodated at the flying boat base called New Camp, where space was found for the majority of the corporals and Irks to sleep in the hangar, where Catalinas and Sunderlands were maintained. A few of us were put in a Nissen hut behind the hangar. Shortly after getting to New Camp, we were paraded in an otherwise deserted hangar to be addressed by Wing Commander McLean, who was obviously aware of all the trials and tribulations, as he had spent all his time aboard Eagle as well, and was very appreciative of all our efforts. That was the good news, he said. But remembering that we had been under the impression that we might be home in 6 weeks after assembling and dispatching the 16 Spitfires, he had now received orders to retain us in Gib to erect and dispatch a further batch of 16. In the meantime, we could have 2 days off to swim and sunbathe. When that couple of days were over, we were employed on various duties and fatigues at New Camp or dismantling crashed aircraft at North Front. I spent a few days digging trenches for the army, who were running signal cables, etc., into a new development in the interior of the rock. With the arrival of the second batch of 16, and the limited publicity given by the UK press to the arrival in Malta of the first Spitfires, the security aspects of our work relaxed a bit. After all, the Germans probably guessed how the Spitfires had arrived in Malta, which was much the same way that Hurricanes had, again, by carrier. So the new batch of crates were again offloaded onto the quayside in the inner harbour, but in due course were ferried by lighter round to the slipway at New Camp. The Royal Air Force Marine Craft Section, with their flying boat tenders, etc., played a large part in moving the laden lighters round the harbour. These movements had to tie in with tides. Once the lighter was loaded, with two crates if I remember correctly, the tender would strap the lighter alongside with suitable ropes and bring the cargo round to the slipway, where a coal's crane offloaded each crate onto the apron in front of the hangar. Uncrating and assembly then took place there and or in the hangar in much the same way as on the Eagle, etc. we were given to understand that Jumbo Gracie was very concerned that he and his pilots, who like Stan Grants had had no carrier experience, were expected to fly aircraft off which had not been test flown since reassembly, with compasses that had not been swung, and whose armament had not been fired in the air. Furthermore, the Vichy French were upset about some particular incident that escapes me after all these years, and it was thought might try air raids on the Rock in retaliation. Although the anti-aircraft guns, etc. at Jib were said to be adequate, fighter defence was limited to any Royal Air Force or Fleet Air Arm aircraft that happened to be at North Camp in transit. So a scheme was devised to cater for these various situations. As soon as the assembly, etc. of the first pair of Spitfires was complete, our friends from the Marine Craft section brought an empty lighter to the slipway as before, and the two Spitfires were manhandled aboard and secured for the sea trip round to a suitable spot near the runway at North Front. The runway in those days didn't project as far into the sea as it does now. At North Front, the compasses were swung, the aircraft air-tested, including the firing of armament, and when declared serviceable, were on readiness as standby fighter defence Gibraltar. When the next pair were assembled, they would follow the same routine and would then be made available to replace the first pair, and so on. I don't recall any occasion when their services were called for. To try to confuse the enemies in Algeciras, it was arranged for a lighter with two Spitfires aboard to be tied up to a buoy out in the anchorage, and as the aircraft ex-North Front became available, they would be moved out on lighters and then onto Eagle at night, always ensuring that there were two aircraft left on a lighter before daybreak at the usual buoy in the anchorage. Thus it was hoped that the spies would not know how many Spitfires had been loaded onto Eagle. When the 16 were completed and the last pair loaded again in the dark, Eagle sailed on March the 20th, leaving the fighter defensive Gibraltar to take care of itself. And according to my notes, we flew the first flight off in the morning of the 21st of March, with a delay in seeing the rest of them. I can't recall the details. Of course, on return to Jib, we were again addressed by Wing Commander McLean, who had to apologise again, as we were expected to continue, and the batch size increased to the extent that, in addition to what could be accommodated in the hangar deck of Eagle, we would sail with a number lashed down on the flight deck. We kept this up through the rest of March, April, May and June. On his way home at the end of his tour as AOC Malta, we were addressed by Air Marshal Hugh Lloyd, who thanked us not only for the work we had done, but for the various bundles of goodies, cigarettes, etc., which we had asked the pilots to deliver to the boys on the island. As the months passed, our usual practice when preparing to fly off was to have as many aircraft on the round down, aft end of the flight deck, and start up each aircraft in turn. The pilot would taxi forward to line up on the centre line, with Wing Commander McLean beside the cockpit, checking the setting of prop pitch controls, then with four bods on the tail and two lying on the deck holding the chocks in, a run-up. On receipt of a signal, all the bods got off, chocks out, tail up, brakes off, and away she went. I can still sense the heat from the flight deck. Eventually, as the summer progressed, reduced wind speed over the flight deck at takeoff presented problems. The flaps on the Spitfire were either up or down, and always remained up at takeoff. It was concluded that a small amount of flap at takeoff would improve lift, so a method of setting takeoff flap was devised using blocks of wood of appropriate shape. The procedure was to arrange, whilst each aircraft was being prepared for flight, to lower the flaps, the wooden blocks inserted in the wing trailing edge flap shroud, and the flaps selected up. This trapped the blocks to hold the flaps at what was found to be the optimum position for takeoff. After getting his aircraft airborne and at a safe height and speed, the pilot selected flaps down, which allowed the blocks to drop away, so that with flaps and undercarriage up, he had a clean aircraft. The Spitfire's performance on takeoff in the conditions prevailing in the Med during the summer also featured during the preparations for the latter reinforcement operations in support of Pedestal, the August 1942 convoy. Several batches, up to 32 at a time, were handled up to the end of June without loss, as far as I know. There was one which developed an internal glycol leak or similar, which warranted a ferry back to Gibraltar, so Wing Commander McLean tried his hand at a carrier takeoff quite successfully and landed the aircraft back at North Front for an engine change. The American carrier USS Wasp joined in, although I wasn't unable to witness the joint operations. We didn't all go down the Mediterranean on every trip. About the end of June, we were joined by a crowd of new lads out from England, intended to supplement our efforts, but by dint of some persuasion from Wing Commander McLean and Shorty Hughes, the powers that be agreed that the new lads could be used to replace the equivalent numbers of the original Special Operations Maintenance Party, who had been given to understand that they were on a 6 weeks detachment and not on an overseas posting. So those originals, who had compassionate grounds to offer as a reason to return home, were first considered, and the names of the rest by trade and rank were put in the hat and the appropriate numbers drawn out to indicate who went home. I was one of those to have his name drawn out. I should think we were originally about 70 strong, and about half of those sailed with me on the troop ship Narkunda on the 6th of June 1942 with a forward destroyer escort. Among our fallen passengers were a number of RAF aircrew who had been shot down and escaped by various routes through Europe down to Gib, assisted by the escape organisation. We also had some of the seriously wounded from Malta who had either been flown out or brought out on the Royal Naval vessels that did the high-speed dash from Gibraltar to Malta and back, like mine layers HMS Welshman and HMS Manxman, I believe. We anchored in the Clyde on the 12th of July and travelled by train, etc., down to Cranfield overnight and went straight on 7 days leave. On return, we joined 3501 servicing unit at Cranfield, which was just forming to carry out major servicing on obsolescent marks of Spitfires and Bowfighters withdrawn from squadrons as new marks became available, the old marks being required for use in the operational training units, etc. Within 10 days of our return from leave, about two-thirds of those who had been with SOMP were warned that we might be required for overseas, and by the 30th of July, we were back at RAF West Kirby preparing again for the boat. We moved off by coach and then by train on the evening of August the 1st for another unknown destination. Of course, there were a few among us that took a dim view of another overseas posting without leave. Dolly Gray, I remember, had tried to get taken off before we left Cranfield, even insulting the Flight Sergeant Cook in the airman's mess, expecting to be put on a charge and thus to be held back, but Chiefy was too wily to fall for that one. Dolly had compassionate reasons for staying in the UK and pursued them at each opportunity, and when we left West Kirby, his case was still under review. As we got onto the train at Lime Street Station in Liverpool, Dolly had just about given up hope when a Royal Air Force Police Corporal came along the platform calling for LAC Grey. Dolly was not coming with us after all. I think it was his father who was very ill and died shortly after. We eventually reached RAF Abbotsinch, or was it Royal Naval Air Station Abbotsinch, during the morning of Sunday the 2nd of August, stayed for a meal and then moved on to Gourock to embark on the aircraft carrier HMS Furious. The Clyde seemed pretty full of merchant ships and naval vessels of various shapes and sizes. HMS Furious was different from Eagle, having two hangar decks, one above the other, and unlike Eagle, which had a smokestack incorporated in the island, Furious smoke dispersed through a sort of matrix in the aft end of the flight deck. She had been loaded with about 40 Spitfires before we went aboard. To get the maximum aircraft on, they had skated Spitfires sideways into the two hangar decks and lashed them down. We had not seen Wing Commander McLean or Squadron Leader Hughes since leaving Gib, as far as I can remember, and we soon found our new engineering officer was Flight Lieutenant Cassells. We didn't have any time to settle down, just dumped kit and started work. We found that all propellers and constant speed units had to be removed and crated before we sailed. It seemed that de Havilland hydromatic propellers as installed would not provide the best takeoff performance from Furious. I don't know how the flight deck length of Furious compared with Eagle, but I've since learned that an early form of ski jump was incorporated in Furious, providing an upward inclination towards the bow that was not readily discernible. There was no time to reposition the aircraft in the hangars, so the removal of the props was undertaken in what space was available. In some cases, this was just sufficient to lift the spinner off without hitting the adjacent bulkhead or hangar wall or whatever in the hangar decks. The props were manhandled off and lowered to the deck to be slid on odd bits of timber under the other aircraft, etc., onto the lift. The replacement rotol props were brought on board from lighters shortly after we got on board. They were already assembled and still in those enormous Y-shaped crates. As soon as the crates started to come aboard, The prop was removed and laid on the flight deck. As each de Havilland prop came up on the lift, it was stowed in the empty crate, loaded back onto the lighter. As soon as every DH prop in its crate was over the side, we were expected to sail. And this work took us through the rest of August the 2nd and 3rd, which was the bank holiday, and the 4th. The hangars were really hot and we really sweated. In the meantime, a lot of the shipping had gone, most of it, I think, shortly after we got aboard Furious on the 2nd. We sailed in the early hours of the 5th, knowing that we had the props and CSUs to fit at sea. By the 6th of August, fresh water was short and the heat in the hangar was terrific. On the 7th, Flight Lieutenant Cassells got into a panic as the work was behind schedule and we had to sweat blood. I don't think we had much by way of body fluids to use by that time. At some stage, we were told that Furious and her escort should have sailed with the rest of the shipping we had seen in the Clyde, but sailing had been delayed due to the propeller change saga. I believe that the prop changes were necessary as part of the performance exercise I have already referred to when we used the wooden blocks for flat takeoff setting on Eagle. Anyway, it was the intention that we should steam at maximum speed to catch up with the rest of the convoy, which meant that the boilers had priority on fresh water and we might get some of what was left. There was no relaxation of standards. Airmen would rise and shave at reveille was still the rule. Only the Navy wore beards in those days. Salt water was not much use for washing, even if you used the so-called seawater soap. I learned to brush my teeth and shave in a mug of water and scrub round the wash. We caught up with a convoy just before the Straits of Gibraltar and were told that this was the latest attempt to break the siege of Malta. We were carrying our 40 Spitfires, which would fly off, as we had previously done from Eagle, to ensure Malta had sufficient to provide fighter cover for the convoy once it was within range of the island. We might refuel in jib due to the high fuel consumption resulting from the high-speed steaming needed to catch up with the rest of the convoy, but in the event, we sailed into the Med without stopping on the 9th of August. Work on the prop changes and subsequent engine runs was not completed until the 10th. The convoy, later we know was named Pedestal, had a huge Navy presence, including at one time two battleships, Rodney and Nelson, five aircraft carriers, Argus, Victorious, Indomitable, Eagle and Furious, and a vast selection of cruisers, some of which specialised in anti-aircraft defence, including Hermione, Scylla and Charybdis, I think, who had been with us before on the Malta run with Eagle. We lost count of destroyers, frigates and corvettes. The merchantmen were not particularly numerous, but included a tanker, later to be identified as the Ohio. Argus didn't stay long and returned to jib. The convoy exercised, practiced aircraft recognition, and had a practiced anti-aircraft chute. The blue sky was soon shot with hundreds of black or white puffs, and the noise on the flight deck was terrific. All seemed set for a busy time, with confidence high, and most of us in good spirits, though getting weary. Our Spitfires were to be flown off in flights, and about midday on the 11th of August, Furious and Eagle more or less exchanged stations in the convoy to allow us to start flying off, and our first flight was ranged ready to go. Other flights would be brought up from the hangars and ranged in turn. I can't remember how many there were on in each flight, but certainly before we had got them all up from the hangars, and whilst we were actually flying off. Among all the noise of activity on the flight deck, someone pointed to Eagle across the convoy. She was smoking and had a significant list. We continued to fly off and Eagle sank very quickly. One of our Spitfires developed trouble with undercarriage failing to retract, I think, after getting airborne, and landed on Indomitable without too much damage as far as we knew. Quite an achievement for a pilot with no previous experience of carrier landings and landing on with an aircraft not fitted with arrestor gear. Some of Eagle's Fleet Air Arm Squadron aircraft were airborne at the time. She was hit by four torpedoes down one side, and we wondered if Furious would then take over Eagle's role in the convoy. In the event, we stayed until nightfall and then turned for Gibraltar. Perhaps the fuel situation on Furious was a contributing factor in releasing her from the convoy. We arrived back in jib on the 12th, learning that an escorting destroyer had rammed an enemy submarine during the night, and we wondered if it was the one that had sunk Eagle. During the 13th and 14th, we loaded more Spitfires, which our old pals had assembled since we left, and sailed towards Malta on the 16th to fly off on the 17th. I don't think we had lost a Spitfire during our efforts in the last few months, although I believe one from Wasp landed in North Africa. but during the takeoff on the 17th, after several aircraft had got safely airborne, the next pilot got away on his takeoff run, but may have misjudged the effect of the turbulence caused by the island on Furious, because the aircraft launched over the side instead of over the bows. As the aircraft passed over the side, it dropped. The tail end hit a gun position sighted just below deck level, and the next we saw was a large bubbling patch of water with a 90-gallon drop tank in the middle passing astern. The pilot was not recovered. The next pilot due off opened up his engine and made a good launch. We were told that he was a great pal of the one who had just bought it, having joined up and trained together. We later heard that two other pilots had had to bail out on the way to Malta, but there were no further details. After the last one was away, we got back there. Sorry, can I say that again? After the last one was away, we turned again for Jib, arriving back on the 18th to view the pedigree escorts that had got back there too by then. One of the carriers, either Indomitable or Victorious, was badly damaged. A bomb had hit one of the lifts, and there was an enormous hole in one side above the waterline. We saw our pals ashore and sailed for home on the 20th with some of the convoy escorts. Those of our pals who remained in Gibraltar formed the nucleus of the Spitfire Erection Party, set up to assemble Spitfires at North Front in support of the invasion of North Africa, which was to follow later in 1942. Our journey home was made without significant incidents. Rodney and Nelson accompanied us, and I remember one of the pedestal cruisers, HMS Kenya, I think, that had a damaged bows. It showed as the ship pitched. As the bow rose, the jagged outline of the damage showed very clearly, and then went out of sight as she plunged down again into the sea. We got back to Cranfield and started leave again on the 26th of August. Saw some newsreels of the pedestal convoy at the local cinema, and returned to camp on the 2nd of September. I remained at Cranfield for the next few months. Some of the lads went on a detachment to help the Americans service their Spitfires at a satellite of Curtin in Lindsay, but I wasn't chosen. By the beginning of 1943, I was a bit fed up with the job. We didn't spend all our time scraping paint off of bow fighters, but when routine orders asked for volunteers for service in commando units, I was among the first to get my name down. Together with a few others who had been with SOMP, I left Cranfield on the 1st of April 1943 to join 3207 Servicing Commando that was just forming up at RAF Tangmere. That's 3207.
Can you tell me what a servicing commando was?
But that's another story.
Maybe we can go on to it.
Yes.
What is a servicing commando?
Well, it was one of Lord Louis Mountbatten's ideas, I'm told. Basically, they were ground tradesmen of all the aircraft trades who were given additional military training and were to be used when the opportunity required, as for example during the invasions of North Africa, they would have sufficient military training as well as technical skill to go onto an airfield to take it and to maintain the aircraft that came in until such time as the ground crew from the squadrons that owned the aeroplanes could catch up on them, really.
And where were you doing the work with this 3207 commander?